Yeah, let's continue.
Okay, so I forgot two things that I should have said. So one is, so about this condition here. So again, a ribbon knot is, you take the unknot here, you look at the inverse image under closed one, closure one in 2n components, in 2n component tangles, and you project down to here, and this is the set of all ribbon knots. Now, that's actually hidden here is another reason why I care about polynomial time invariance. And the reason is that, suppose the target space was, the dimension of the target space was growing very, very rapidly with the number of components. Okay? So this is actually typically what happens for sort of Young-Baxter style invariance or quantum group style invariance, because the dimension of the target space, if you have n strands, if you basically write, if you have n strands, you have a vector space here, and the vector space is at the ends of the strands, and you take the tensor products of all of these vector spaces, and the dimension of the target space grows exponentially, and therefore every computation in it will be at least exponential time. Okay? But this in itself, just merely the fact that the dimensions grow rapidly, is bad for me. And the reason is as follows. So, suppose the dimension here of the target space of an invariant was way bigger than the dimension here, and way bigger than the dimension here. Then falling into 1 here, so having projection here equal to 1, would be a very mild condition, because this is a relatively small number of conditions, right? So the set you have here, the inverse image, is still relatively big, and you project it into a small thing, and likely it would be surjective. So if you have an invariant with sort of target spaces that grow very, very rapidly with n, likely it will not tell you anything about ribbon knots. And indeed, the Jones polynomial, in fact, the Jones polynomial does have stitching formulas, but it tells you almost nothing about knots, about ribbon knots. Okay? So this was the comment here. So faster is better for obvious reasons, but leaner is meaner, and they'll just explain why. Okay? I also explained why sort of invariants coming directly from quantum groups are just not going to do it, and are very inefficient to compute. Okay, but okay, I ended the previous hour with a promise that everything including implementation fits in one column. So here is the implementation of this invariant. So the key idea is that instead of saving a matrix with entries alpha AB, you save a quadratic form, which is a linear combination of alpha AB, TA, HB, where TA and HB are various formal variables. And then if you want to access a particular row or column of the matrix, all you have to do is to differentiate with respect to these variables and set the rest of the variables to zero. Okay? So that's the key idea to the implementation. So here is the implementation. The first bit right here, you don't want to know anything about it. It's just formatting. This is, I format the output to look like, to look pretty. There's nothing here. No mathematical content. This is the mathematical content. So, you know, connected sum is just the block diagonal. Block diagonal becomes sum of quadratic forms and product of the omega parts. Then the stitching formula, well, first of all, I have to determine what alpha, beta, theta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and so on are. So these are various partial derivatives of the quadratic form with substitutions of things go to zero. Okay? And then I have to produce, once I've determined what alpha, beta, da-da-da are, I have to produce the output, and the output is written here, and it's exactly the formulas from the board, from the handout. So this is a complete implementation. These are the values of the positive crossing and the negative crossing. Here they are. I hit enter, and the computer now knows about my invariant. So now I can check that everything really works. So I have to check meta-associativity, otherwise it's not sort of even, doesn't even make sense. So I enter a sort of generic matrix, and then I take this generic matrix and apply the first stitching, the second stitching, or then in the other order, hit enter, and the computer outputs true. Now, of course, I could have cheated, but believe me, I didn't. Okay? Next, I check the Rademeister 3. So, Rademeister 3 is, well, a stitching of three crossings in two different ways. So here it's 6 over 2, 5 over 1, 3 over 4. So 5 over 1, 6 over 2, 3 over 4. This is just the syntax, okay? I take their disjoint union, I implement it via multiplication, and then I apply to it stitch 1 to 4. So you stitch 1 to 4, then you stitch 2 to 5, then you stitch 3 to 6. Likewise for the other side, you hit enter. This time I didn't compare, I printed. So this is the printout for one side, this is the printout for the other side. You can visually inspect and see that they're equal. Invariant under Rademeister 3. And finally, if I wanted to compute the invariant of some complicated knot, say the 8 crossing knot 817, then I kind of cut it in my mind, and then each crossing gets two labels. So one label for the upper strand, one label for the lower strand. So this is the 12-1 crossing, this is the 2-7 crossing. So here is a negative crossing, minus crossing between 12 and 1, and minus crossing between 2 and 7, and so on. I multiply all of these, and then I apply stitching operations by stitching 1 to 2, calling the result 1. Stitching 1 to 3, calling the result 1. So stitching 1 to 4, calling the result 1. So overall, I just stitch everything. This is this do loop here. Stitch 1 to k, calling the result 1, where k goes from 2 to 16. Again, I hit enter, I get an output, and the output contains the Alexander polynomial right here. So it's just a demo how it works. Okay? This invariant has all the good properties. It's polynomial time, it's really fast, it's very easy to implement. I did tell you about closed components, what to do if you do have closed components. So there is a certain trace operation. Here is what it looks like, here is the implementation. And it was found by my student Eva Halacheva. But we don't yet fully understand it. So over in the stitching operation, there was division by some scalar mu, which we could prove that it is always non-zero. In the case of the trace, there is a division by a scalar mu, but now it's a different scalar. And experimentally, whenever we wanted to compute the trace, it's non-zero, but I don't know how to prove it yet. There are weaknesses as well. So things are non-linear, which makes things complicated. Maybe I will not even tell you. I think I want to move on. It's not really rational functions that appear. It's really rational functions with a fixed denominator. So if you take the matrix and multiply it by the omega part, the result is always just polynomials, Laurent polynomials. This is extremely important if you care about categorification, because people don't know how to categorify rational functions, but they do know how to categorify polynomials. But unfortunately, so the proof that omega times a is a Laurent polynomial is inductive and requires exponentially many conditions. So if there will be a categorification, the categorification will have to use this somehow, so likely it will be an exponential size. Okay. And I think I want to move to where does it all come from. Okay? So, first of all, I have to define what virtual nodes are. So, people in knot theory tend to hate them, by the way. I don't know what to say. So, maybe I'll tell you where they come from. In fact, in some sense, they can come from quantum algebra. So you see, in quantum invariants, in R matrix invariants, the invariant of a crossing is in some tensor product of vector spaces. Maybe some of them are duals, I don't know, okay? And then the way you stitch is by contracting. So, you know, you want to stitch this to this, you contract V with V dual. Okay? But nothing here forces V and V dual to be adjacent. Algebraically, contracts, so if you have the invariant of a complicated tangle, nothing prevents you from contracting this V dual with this V. So the domain of definition of all quantum invariants is a bit bigger than just nodes. Okay? Now, maybe they don't have great properties on these extra things, but still they are defined on a bigger collection of diagrams. And virtual tangles is a formalization of what these diagrams are. So, a virtual tangle, the set of virtual tangles, is the planar algebra. What does planar algebra mean? It just means, well, you know, it has a formal definition, but what it really means, you know, operads, etc. But what it really means is that you start from two planar pictures, the two generators, and then you compose them in the plane in all reasonable, in all possible ways. So you basically make all possible planar pictures from them. So it's the planar algebra generated by these two things. Modulo, the relations, the usual Rademeister relations, and then relations that tell you that you can move the so-called virtual, so these crossings with no indication of which one is over and which one is under are called virtual crossings, so you can move them as you please around each other and with some limitations around ordinary crossings. But what this really amounts to saying is that they're not really there. So when I stitch this end to this end, well, I do it by connecting them by a strand that goes this way, and on the way there are virtual crossings that are not really there, so I could have moved them to be that way and it would be the same. Okay? Alternatively, and a slightly better definition is to say that virtual tangles are the circuit algebra generated by the crossing symbol modulo the usual Rademeister relation. So essentially it's just the same as ordinary knots. In ordinary tangles you'd say the planar algebra generated by this picture modulo the Rademeister moves, and the only thing I'm changing is I'm changing from a planar algebra to a circuit algebra. What's a circuit algebra? So I think it's what some people call modular operad. I just learned it over lunch, but I don't want to be committed to that, so I'll just call it the way I like to. I just still call it circuit algebra. So what's a circuit algebra? It's roughly what you get when you have electronic components, so circuits. So, you know, you have transistors, and you have resistors, and you have capacitors, and these are the basic electronic components, and you can connect them to each other to make bigger circuits, and these bigger circuits are again circuits. So you can connect them with other circuits. And it just completely doesn't matter, electrically speaking, how the wires go. The wires are just logical connections of ends to ends. So a circuit algebra is the algebra that the chips inside my laptop are connected with. Okay? And within the chips, the individual components. So logically speaking, this is just a big element in a circuit algebra. So that's a virtual knot. Yet another way to visualize it is to think that, well, Pogs are these kids' game, maybe some of you know them. It's those little discs on which things are printed. So you take a number, and they tend to fly in the air. So you take a number of Pogs on which crossings are printed, and the ends of the Pogs are connected to each other, but I really don't care where. So the Pogs are really how. I mean, so the Pogs are sort of are somehow in hyperspace, but the connections between them are logical, not physical. Okay, so that's the blue stuff here. Yet another view is that this is the metamonoid defined by a single crossing modulo the Rademeister moves, where a metamonoid is something on which a stitching operation is defined, just as before, which satisfies a meta-associativity property and a few other minor properties. Okay? So all of these are definitions of virtual tangles, and in some sense, they are the honest domain space of quantum invariants. And I'm being slightly dishonest now, because in quantum invariants there are also values for caps and caps, so Pogify these two. But I'm not showing this. Okay? Good. Now, start from virtual knots, virtual tangles, and do to them exactly what I was promoting before. Oh, okay, never mind. Exactly what I was promoting before. Namely, allow yourself to take formal linear combinations, look at the augmentation ideal, so the ideal generated by an overcrossing minus no crossing, or and then look at the associated graded. So look at the product of I to the n modulo I to the n plus 1. It's a bit hard to digest, but really, what does an element of I to the n look like? So it looks like a thing that has n circled crossings, 1, 2, 3, and maybe a large number of further ordinary crossings, and they are all stitched together, not necessarily in a planar way, okay? And the circled crossings really stand, each one stands for the difference between a crossing and a no crossing. So this really stands for 2 to the n ordinary virtual tangles. And then you look at I to the n modulo I to the n plus 1, and you can show that if you look at this sort of semi-topological gadget here and mod out by I to the n plus 1, what remains is only combinatorics. Okay? And, you know, you work hard and you find what this combinatorics is, and let me tell you what it is. So, I to the n modulo I to the n plus 1, or the direct sum of all of these, is the set of these arrow diagrams modulo combinatorial relations. These are now completely, these arrow diagrams are now completely graph theoretic. There is no over, there is no under, it's just combinatorics. Messy combinatorics, but combinatorics. Now, what's an arrow diagram? An arrow diagram corresponding to a skeleton of S strands. So here, there is sort of, you can count how many strands there are, but an arrow diagram to a skeleton with S strands has S black vertical lines, in this case two, and in between them arrows that you know, go from various points along these lines to various other points, but also to internal trivalent vertices. There are two types of internal trivalent vertices. The co-bracket vertex, where one line enter and two come out, and the bracket vertex, where two lines enter and one comes out. And you mod out by a collection of relations. Most of them are written here, but highly checks was shown before in this meeting, so I'm not showing it. And there is some fine print, and the degree is the overall number of vertices divided by two. Okay, so that's, after all, a gradient space. Now, you know, in my language I already sort of indicated that this is somehow also can be interpreted as a universal enveloping algebra of the double of a Levi algebra raised to some tensor power. I think the key point in what I said was universal. I said the word universal twice. So, universal enveloping algebra, well, okay, if you have a Levi algebra, its double is again a Levi algebra, and then the universal enveloping algebra of that, you all know what it is. And this is sort of a universal model of such universal enveloping algebra, in the sense that elements here represent formulas that make sense in all of these. Okay? So any specific element here represents a formula that generates an element in any such thing for any specific finite dimensional Levi algebra. Okay? Now, without details, how is the formula constructed? Roughly speaking, you interpret arrow tails as element of the dual, arrow heads as elements of the algebra itself. These vertices become the co-bracket, these vertices become the bracket, and the strands become multiplication in the universal enveloping algebra. So this is a certain product of things which appear in, well, again, I said without details, so it will remain without details.
So the S is the number of strands?
Yeah. S is the set of labels of strands. It's not a number, it's a set. Okay, yes.
So here for AV, you have two definitions to be the global.
Sorry?
You have two definitions here for AV.
AV.
You define the space AV to be the product of I and the range of time.
Yeah.
To be the presentations with diagrams.
Yeah.
So is it obvious that this should be equal, those two spaces?
No.
Okay. So it's
put. So, okay. So now here and there one has to be honest. It's somewhere halfway between a theorem and a conjecture. But in some, okay. So let me also say that in some sense it's irrelevant because I'm going to look at various quotients of this, and the theorem is really just motivation. It's more than a... I don't really use the theorem, I only use the confidence it gives me. And I'm sufficiently confident. Okay, now to be a bit more honest, let me explain more and then the honesty will come out. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, here is the likely theorem. And this theorem is really due to Ettinghoff and Kashdan and Enrique, and later by Enriquez in different ways, and probably also by Chevera in yet another way. And this theorem, so they call it the quantization of Lie-by algebras, but I only need a part of that. And that part is the fact that every infinitesimal Young, every solution of the infinitesimal Young-Baxter equation integrates to a solution of the global Young-Baxter equation. And furthermore, the proofs that they give of this statement are universal. So they all happen, so the statements they phrase in a world which looks like this, but the proofs they give in a world that looks like this, even though it's very, very hard to read it between the lines in what they say, but that's what they do. And Benjamin here agrees with me, I hope.
Yes, yes, well, we discussed it.
Yeah. Okay. So, anyway, that theorem really is, that theorem really becomes the theorem that there exists an expansion, which is exactly the thing that I've defined previously, going from virtual tangles to AV. And Gwenaël, as you know, the existence of expansions actually also identifies the target space as being the right target space.
It's the weaker.
What?
The second statement is weaker than the existence of expansions.
Yes. Yes. So therefore, a likely theorem is that there is a map from virtual tangles into this space, which respect all the operations. There is an obvious stitching operation here, which is you just connect the end of one strand to the tail of the other. Okay? So this is the likely theorem. There is such an expansion. Now, the issues that I'm suppressing are, first of all, that these theorems are written in completely different languages and nobody had written yet a proof precisely in this language, so there might be something there. And secondly, there are issues with caps and caps that may or may not get us into trouble. So I'm a bit imprecise in the statement, but at least morally speaking, or there is, so literally speaking, it may be false, but if it is false, then there is a neighboring theorem which is true. Okay. Anyway, this is still way too hard, because first of all, it contains all of quantum algebra, and therefore, and since quantum algebra was too hard, this is definitely too hard. This is universal quantum algebra. These spaces grow in an extremely rapid way. It's completely useless from my perspective. But the idea is to look at quotients on which the metamonoid operations remain well-defined. So the stitching operation remains well-defined. And then there are several cross quotients to look at, and I'm becoming more and more vague as I go, I'm sorry. So then there are several quotients to look at, and the first quotient, and also I failed to refresh my screen at the beginning, so I don't know how much time I have.
Well, it depends, it's always negotiable, but how much time do you need?
3 hours?
that's probably too much. But the dinner is in what?
Okay.
30 minutes, so I would say half an hour would it be, or
okay. So I'll try to do less. I will definitely do less. So okay. One quotient is the co-commutative quotient. So you kill all the co-brackets. You just declare if the diagram has a co-bracket, it's equal to zero. If a diagram of this type has a vertex which is 1 in, 2 out, you set it to 0. Algebraically, it's like saying that you speak about co-commutative Levi algebras. And that turns out to have a topological meaning, in fact. So this particular quotient has a topological meaning. Namely, there is a map from nodes in space to nodes in to knotted tubes in four-dimensional space. Basically, you map a crossing to a pair of tubes that that sort of are knotted with each other in four-dimensional space. And here is an illustration. So, sort of, you know, in ordinary knot theory, when you have a gap in a diagram, it really means that this trans sort of goes down in the fourth coordinate. So here I've drawn two tubes in R3, but I put gaps in them to indicate that this one goes down briefly in fourth space. And here I've put an annular hole to say that here the red one goes down briefly in four-dimensional space. So this defines a map from knotted strands to knotted tubes. And it turns out that the part of four-dimensional knot theory that you get corresponds to imposing this relation. Okay? So it's not so this W quotient is actually topologically meaningful. And again, I'm slightly dishonest. By the way, this is another picture of a two-dimensional knot in R4, so where the fourth coordinate is indicated by color. And well, it's sort of in the image of this picture, of this map, but without details. Okay, maybe I'll analyze maybe in one word, AW, so the W quotients, becomes completely understandable. Namely, AW becomes the universal enveloping algebra. After you model by everything, after you model by the co-brackets, you're only left with brackets. And the only diagrams you can make out of brackets are essentially trees and wheels. And you can translate it into the fact that AW is the universal enveloping algebra of a freely algebra raised to some power and then cyclic words on that same alphabet, and then this expansion becomes a fully rigorous and fully well defined and provably with no lies expansion with values here, and this is the one that I've computed earlier. Sorry for being so extra super weight. So this is theorem 2 by Barnatan and Danchov, that there is actually a homomorphic expansion into this freely algebra business, and the computation of before, here it is again in a more colorful way. Okay? So this is all, and here again, this is where the fancy freely algebra calculator was used. And this is all nice, but still way too hard, because the freely algebra still grows exponentially, and the set of cyclic words still grows exponentially. So I'm still not getting where I want to be. Okay, but then you can mod out by even more relations. So you can mod out by the relation written here, which says that wherever you have a bracket, you can replace it by this diagram minus that diagram, where this diagram is a closed loop with a line entering into it and an arrow going from here to here, and similarly here, but with somehow different, well, the connections are different. This, by the way, I call it B because it's really the trace of the bracket operation, right? Over here, no matter how you orient this circle, it's oriented counterclockwise. This is a bracket, and I'm taking the bracket, the trace of the bracket operation with respect to one of the variables, so it's an element in the dual of the Lie algebra. So, so, So B is that element. It stands for, this is the bracket trace. And if you look at this relation screams, my Lie algebra is two-dimensional. Right? Because really what it says is that the bracket of any two things is a comp, right, this is just the identity span, this really represents for the identical map, identity map. So the bracket of U and V is a combination of V and U. So the bracket of any two things is a combination of its of the two inputs, that's a two-dimensional Lie algebra. So anyway, I can mod out by this relation, which sort of universally says that the algebra is two-dimensional. And then, basically, all the internal vertices disappear. I only have b's, and the b's you can show commute with each other. So I end up in a target space with a very small size. And specifically, so again, if you look at AV, you mod out by the co-bracket is equal to zero, you get just wheels and trees. I still modulo the Jacobi relation. And then I mod out further by this 2D relation. And what do I have left? The only thing I can have after I mod out by this relation is, well, all the trees collapse to single lines, which are labeled tail with some letter J and head with some letter K, where J and K run inside S. And I also have a number of B's, which is sort of a commutative, again, they're labeled by letters, but otherwise are like commutative variables. So I get an answer in, well, these arrows really become matrix entries, so this corresponds to an entry of the matrix in position JK, and these become variables. So I get an answer in S by S matrices with entries in this ring of power series in the variables bi. But I can sometimes get diagrams like if I start from a wheel, I will get everything will collapse. I will even not have this one line. So I will just get an element of this algebra, so the, of this ring. So the output is in a power series version of the ring promised before. And then the rest is a very hard calculation of how exactly the operations from the stitching operations become operations on freely words and cyclic words, and modulo these relations, how they become algebraic operations on this target space, and you find that these, they become simple-minded operations, and after a few changes of variables, you get a result, the results that I started with. So it's very hard and very messy, but that's where it comes from. Anyway, where it came from, there is more. Namely, I can now look at other relations. I can mod out AV by different collections of relations. So now, let's not mod out by the co-bracket vanishes. So the co-bracket no longer vanishes, but just declares that the Lie by algebra is two-dimensional, or universally two-dimensional. Being universally two-dimensional becomes these three relations. So the anti-symmetrization of the bracket, well, the bracket is already anti-symmetrization, so this anti-symmetric, so this is a waste of time, is equal to the anti-symmetrization of this picture. This is the same relation as before. In fact, the point here is that a wedge 2 of a two-dimensional space is one-dimensional. So if you anti-symmetrize two legs, so if you have two diagrams that are both are anti-symmetric, they must be proportional. So this must be equal, well, proportional to that. And likewise, this must be proportional to this, where this is the co-bracket trace. And finally, there is a certain swinging relation that defined here. And you get a quotient which is still, which is quite small, and it contains in it anything that two-dimensional Lie algebras can see, and this includes two-dimensional Lie algebras can see, and this includes the Jones and Alexander polynomials. But if you look, but if you actually try to work with it, you find that it is still way too high. So the next thing is to look at the sort of a close approximation to the W quotient. So instead of killing a single co-bracket, he declares that whenever you have two co-brackets, everything vanishes. So you're sort of looking at the at most one application of the co-bracket is available. And in this case, everything drops to being polynomial size, and everything should work, and I'm working, you know. I said that this is work in progress. So this is the part that is in progress. Very, very briefly, if you look at diagrams, sort of Lie algebra diagrams, where only one co-bracket is allowed, you can get a very limited collection of diagrams. You can get trees and wheels as before. Wheels and trees as before, these have zero co-brackets in them. But you can also have diagrams that have one co-bracket and look like a fork, sort of a branch out fork, or or, you know, something enters, splits into two, and then rejoins. And here there might be more bracket vertices. And then this is the final possibility. And then when you mod out by the two-dimensional relations, the two-dimensional relations allow you to collapse all vertices. And it turns out that the only thing you could possibly be left with is well, the old target space plus a certain number of diagrams that look like this, a certain number of diagrams that look like a single line but with an extra delta, where delta is this little picture here, or, well, pairs like this, or a pair of lines. And that's all you get. But this really means that the target space is a, well, if V sub S is a is a module over S, over RS, is the free module with S generators over RS, then this stands for, that's a mistake, this really should have been RS. S by S matrices is VS tensor squared. The amount of information that's here, there is only one label here, so it's again VS. Here there are two labels, so this is VS tensor squared. Here there are three labels, so this is VS cubed. And here there are four labels, so it lives in a subset of VS tensor to the fourth. But then there is the swinging relation, so it actually reduces down to the symmetric power of VS tensor squared. So this might look awful, but it's still polynomial. It's still a degree 4 polynomial in the size of V, which is still relatively small. Now, here is a little proposition. So the elements Rij given below solve the Young-Baxter equation. So And the elements, well, again, without details, are given by rather messy formulas. So there are combinations of the elements that I wrote before with coefficients that are various annoying functions. And that's where I'm at. So stitching is clearly defined because it came from a place where stitching exists, but the explicit formulas are still too complicated for me to work out. And, yeah, I think I'm already way too vague, so maybe I should just, I should quit when you still have minimal amount of confidence in me.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
So, you know, if I were to summarize, sort of, No, I have some ideology and I know where it's going, and there is a lot of hard work to finish it. Yes.
I have an opinionated statement.
Good.
I think you should use the language of corporates.
I have an opinionated opinion too. No. So, I admit that I was not the clearest, but the reason was not the language, the reason was my confused mind. Yes.
What about the so you described, especially towards the end, several concrete invariants, and is there understanding what is the field theoretic or kind of maybe Lagrangian field theoretic origin of them? For instance, this last one, do we kind of can one imagine some kind of Lagrangian quantum field theory which produces this diagrammatics? So that would be one question, maybe a somewhat more detailed question. You're saying you only allow the coproduct to work once. What does it actually mean? Does it mean that I should think that the coefficient in front of a coproduct squares to zero, or is it just some part of a diagrammatic expansion of your field theory?
So you asked two questions.
Yes.
So, okay. The field theoretic interpretation of the W part, where there are no coproducts at all, is probably BF theory, and we probably talked about it before. And I'm saying probably because there are still issues. Okay. Again, getting into what are the issues. So the Feynman diagrams are the right Feynman diagrams, but with wrong signs and sort of minor issues that are not sorted out. It might be not so minor. Okay. If you look beyond AW, so if you look at AV without modding out by the core bracket, then that becomes a question to somebody much more intelligent than me. Namely, you know, I'm a combinatorial technician. I don't know these things. I don't know of a field theoretic interpretation. For all I know, the big experts, so Ettinghoff, Kashdan, Enriquez, Pavel, or also people like Alberto Cattaneo, who kind of know how to find a quantum field theory to suit your perturbation theory. So at least he did it for some Poisson quantization thing. For all I know, these people have not found the quantum field theory yet that describes quantization of Lie algebra. So I don't know. Okay. Now for your other question. So I tend to think combinatorially, and combinatorially, this quotient kill anytime you have two core brackets, kill it. Combinatorially, this makes sense, and I know it works. I suspect that algebraically it stands for thinking of Lie by algebras with a core bracket proportional by epsilon to epsilon, where epsilon squared is equal to zero. But I don't want to be committed.
But then in the end, like you allow not to use it at all or use it once?
Yes.
But then both are in the end separately or not?
It's sort of a filtered situation. So, right, there is an invariant.
But the one that you didn't use the bracket, you already convinced us it was an invariant.
Yes.
So, to what extent it's filtered? It sounds more like gradient.
No, I mean, if you only care about the invariant, then it's graded.
Mm-hmm.
But the operations will be filtered. So it's I mean, this is a part that I skipped, and it's not quite a semi-direct product, but it's sort of a bit. It's essentially an extension. So, so it's the analog of, you know, you have a group G and it maps into G mod H, and then sort of the operations on G cover the operations on G mod H, but if you want to understand the operations in G in terms of the operations in G mod H and the operations of H, you need a little bit of extra. So, so it's roughly this situation. Yes?
Why would you need a quantum compute model for quantization of your bio? There is an explicit formula. Configuration spaces, integrals, and you can cook it. It's not a quantum field theory, but still there is a formula to all degrees.
So, two things. First of all, in some... Okay. The role of the big theorem in this picture is really just to inspire confidence in me. I mean, I'm looking for a very detailed answer inside sort of a very specific space, and the role of the big theorem is to inspire confidence that the answer will be found. And in fact, you know, partially it is found. But the big theorem is actually completely useless for the purpose of finding the answer. Just as the theory of, this is the analog of the fact that the theory of associators is completely useless for actually finding the Jones polynomial, say. Because, you know, we can't find an associator. An associator is way more complicated than its various projections. So, yes, maybe there are explicit formulas, so, or you will be telling us, I presume, that there are explicit formulas for the R matrix, for this universal R matrix. But they're not explicit formulas that you can, they live in huge spaces and you cannot.
Yeah, you have to integrate forms which you cannot integrate.
Yeah, so it inspires confidence but gives no practical help.
No, so, if you understand a number as conceptually as a period, then this is the answer. We know all periods, I mean all
right, but you have
spaces
an exponential,
and integrals.
You have an exponential number
which give us the answer.
You have an exponential number of such periods,
yes.
And you have no idea what are the relations between them from
no,
the computational.
No, relations. It falls from the computification structure. It's relations we can write down.
Still, you are in a huge space, and you really don't know how to work in.
No, but equations can be written down absolutely any of them. There are infinite number of equations can be written explicitly.
Even if you could tell me that the coefficients, so you know, whenever you write a big diagram with arrows going in all directions, you know, if you could tell me, I look at this diagram and the coefficient is 1/7 because something, and all the round numbers are rational numbers, and this 1 over 7 is easy to compute, still the space of such diagrams is so huge, I have nothing to do with your answer, except being inspired.
Correct, because there are a lot of equations, and equations are also parameterized by graphs.
Yeah.
So I take a graph, and out of this, I cook equations for these numbers which quantize. This, of course, out of control.
Again, you know, I tend to write computer programs that fit in one corner of the screen. I can't do it with this. But you see, speaking in this sort of rant that I had in the beginning, I care about the polynomial time, and the stuff that you're telling me about is highly exponential, but it does have a philosophical value, or, you know, and from my perspective, an indirect value. Namely, it tells me that I will be able to find my polynomial things.
Can you use this kind of abstraction, this kind of computations for Joe's polynomials or for the Feynman polynomials or Feynman anything?
So,
or you just construct a new invariant?
So, okay, the Alexander polynomial is fully done, and these are the best formulas there are for the Alexander polynomial. So, I have nothing to be shy about. Already, sort of at the level of G mod H. Yeah. Okay? But the next degree is actually not the, it's probably not, so no, the answer to your question is no, I cannot do the Jones polynomial in a similar way, but the thing that probably will arise is the following, and this is conjectural, but I have good reasons to believe in it. So, you know, if you, the Jones polynomial is really a family of polynomials parameterized by some color lambda, and right, the dimension of the representation. And when you expand them as a power series, there is a sort of another formal variable x, and you get a formal power series at the end, you get something that you can interpret as a formal power series in x and lambda, okay? And then you get an array of coefficients. So this array of coefficients turns out to be zero below the diagonal. Along the diagonal, if you look carefully, you can read the Alexander polynomial. In fact, the inverse of the Alexander polynomial. Power series, which is the inverse of the Alexander polynomial, but it's still the Alexander polynomial information, theoretically. And I think what I will be computing over here is the diagonal above. Now, in as much as information is concerned, well, it's not the Jones polynomial. The Jones polynomial would be this line. But it has sort of comparable amount of information because it's a line of coefficients, and it's much easier to compute.
So no more questions.